Hey, JD here. Welcome to the Meat House. You know, we're just three guys sitting around a table talking about making good meat at home, and once in a while, we wander out in the yard and talk a little brewing, too. You can contact us on our website, themeathouse.com, Facebook and Twitter, both at The Meat House, and you can listen to the podcast with your favorite player, and be sure and rate us 5 stars on iTunes or your favorite listening venue. The Meat House, meat-making entertainment you just don't want to miss. In the house tonight, it's just me and Jeff. Poor Ryan, he's homesick, and we wish Ryan all the best. Get well soon and come on back. But he's lucky because he's gonna get the next couple of weeks off, Jeff. This is our 6 week, so we go on hiatus again for a couple of weeks, and we'll be back. I believe it's March 7th. I think. Check my notes here. I think it's March 7th.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, back on March 7th. So, Ryan, again, hope you're feeling better, bud. What are we drinking, Jeff? What you put in your glass tonight?
Well, you know, I have a little bit of a story behind this. I have a nectarine mead that I made last year. And actually, last year, around the early part of the summertime, I put together a few different meads that were all kind of stone fruity. I had a plum and I had a nectarine, and then I had I've mentioned before the mulberries that were from my yard. Those all went pretty well. Then later in the summer I had a blueberry mead that I put together. The mulberry got bottled. The others, they never really cleared properly. The blueberry kind of sat because I was gonna back sweeten it, and it wound up getting kind of put on the back burner. But regardless, I had a plum and I had a nectarine that were sitting and sitting and sitting because they just wouldn't clear no matter how much, you know, pectin treatment I put in them or other findings and things like that. I think I tried bentonite and maybe even sparkwood, and nothing. I couldn't get it clear for the life of me. And wow. Finally, like a week ago, I was cleaning out the little cabinet that I keep my 1 gallon batches in because, you know, it just needed to happen. I needed more space. And lo and behold, this nectarine mead had finally cleared. The plum got poured down the drain because it was looking bad and kind of tasted bad. But this nectarine mead surprised me. So I bottled it up, and I poured myself a nice big glass today. You know, I wish I had tasted a little bit more thoroughly after I discovered it had cleared, rather than just rushing right to putting it in bottles and getting that fermenter turned around for another batch. Because this is, you know, I'm glad we're recording this, because this is going to be a rare thing for me to say. This is a little too dry.
A little too dry.
I think this would have turned out better if I had back sweetened it just a little bit. And the reason I say that, you know, it has a really pleasant nectarine aftertaste flavor. That characteristic fruitiness and juiciness really comes through, like, on that, the aftertaste more than anything else. You get it like a mouthful of that nectarine flavor after you take a swig. But that first little bit, you get a little bit of tannin, you get a lot of that dry alcohol flavor, and it's not the most pleasant thing in the world. Yeah, this could be a smooth, easy drinker with a little bit of honey to just calm that down a little bit.
There you go. Well, it sounds good.
Yeah. So. You know, we know that for next batch.
There you go, yeah. And, you know, this is why it's so important to take very copious notes. So, you know, the next time you come around to want to make that batch, you know, you've made one already, you know, put your thoughts down on paper and you know, make the adjustments that you got to make, you know, for the next batch. So,
right.
I mean, that's, you know, I depend on that too. I mean, you know, when I drink... I don't know that I'll make this again, but I'm drinking this rum. You know, I saved about a 6-pack, and I tossed the rest of it because it wasn't happening for me. It wasn't. I got to be enthused about something, and I don't know that there was really any way to fix this. Now I think I made a mistake. I probably should have hung on to it, because now that it is sat for, you know, a couple of months, it's tasting a little bit different. There's a little bit of a sweetness to it at the very end. Which is kind of pleasing, actually. It still has the coconut. I can still pick out the coconut, although the coconut seems to be dissipating a little bit, and I've read that about coconut, that like hops, eventually the coconut flavor will kind of go away.
That makes sense.
And that's why I used the entire bottle of the Malibu rum, and it was one of the 750 bottles, not the great big bottles that you see real often, but I can pick out the pineapple, I get the mango, so I get all of those different flavors. And then of course there was hops in it. I used the Citra hops, to give it kind of a citrusy kind of flavor, and those are kind of dissipating a little bit too, but this has turned into something. It's a little more refreshing now than it was before. It was a little harsh before, not alcohol harsh. There was just too much going on. Things were competing with one another. And I think even the honey aroma is starting to come out more. So, typical meads, I mean, the longer they sit, the better they get.
Right.
And so this is not bad. I kind of wish now I would have saved it. But, you know, like I said, I write down all of my thoughts. If I do make this again, I'll make some adjustments. I didn't toast the coconut. I probably should have toasted the coconut. I think that would have contributed a little bit more coconut flavor. I'm not sure what the rum thing. I'm not quite sure, but I mean, you get a sense of the rum, but not the rum, not a real strong rum flavor like I was hoping for. And so it might have been a mistake using that Malibu coconut rum. I may do something different, as far as the rum goes. I mean, even soaking some wood, a light oak, maybe an American oak, which is a little bit lighter oak flavor than the French and Hungarian, So that's what I'm doing tonight. Plus, I got, I just, every time I walk past the shelf, this thing is right at eye level, the Smoky Pete. I've been saving this, this is a small batch and wildly desirable. Let me tell you, it is. This is Ash Fishbein's contribution to the Mead House here a while back when he was on the show. Sent the three of us a bottle of this Smoky Pete. This stuff is amazing, dude. It's really good.
It's really good. Between people I've let try it from my own personal bottle and just people I've talked to that listen to the show, I know we have sold like half a dozen just talking about it on the show and like the bottles that Ash has sent us. So,
yeah,
I assure anyone listening at home, it does live up to the hype that we give it. It is so good.
Yeah. We need to contact him and find out if he's still making it. So Ash, if you're listening, dude, I hope you're still making this Smoky Pete because this is really amazing stuff. So I'm going to have a little couple of fingers of that and a little bit later on. I'm trying to hoard it,
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've got a little tasting glass and I'll fill up like probably a dram at a time, just like sip and savor. It's so good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love just I've got these little bourbon glasses. Jeez, boy, what a frustrating day. I can't remember the name of these damn glasses. A little bell-shaped, what are the name of these?
Glencairn?
Glencairn, yeah. I put a little in a Glencairn and kind of swirl around and take a couple of sniffs and a little bit of a sniff and taste it again, a little bit more sniff. You know, I mean, oh, man, that stuff is good. Anyway, enough of that. So rather than do the Facebook shout outs, we're going to save that for a little bit later on. Yeast banking. You know, is this anything like, you know, and something that I wanted to try is saving some of the yeast that I use in making, like, you know, the beers that I make, the stouts and porters and whatnot. Washing yeast. Is mm-hmm. it something along that lines?
Well, kind of. You know, when we talk about washing yeast, or in the case of some of the things Ryan has tried, basically like pitching over the yeast cake, the idea there is that you're taking more or less a live yeast culture, and you're gonna get the crud off of it, of course, in the washing process, or, you know, maybe not in Ryan's case. He had that was it a sizer that he had pitched onto a piment or something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah, and well, it was a really interesting brew because it had a little bit of that piment character left over into it. But I'm digressing. In that case, you're talking about taking a live yeast culture and basically just reintroducing it to a new must or to new wort and letting it take off from there. What I'm more interested in doing is basically saving this yeast strain indefinitely. And if I can hold on to it for a longer period of time, the longer I can hold on to it, the better. Because, you know, as I've talked about on the show, my temperature control is not where I want it to be. And I keep having grandiose plans that kind of go sideways on me with the temperature controlled fridge plan that I was making with. And then the fridge compressor went out and that just didn't work out for me. But this is a lager strain that I've been working with because it's one of the Y-East special edition lager strains that I, to be perfectly honest, I must have drank my body weight several times over in this stuff when I was living in the Czech Republic for just a couple of years. this Gambrinus strain from Pilsen. And the funny thing is, it's not the greatest beer out there. It's really... it's light. It's not the most flavorful beer. It's really a working class blue collar beer, but it is so, like, so ubiquitous, so frequently found, and just like it's cheap, it's accessible, and it became like the thing that I was drinking all the time. And yeah, you know, the funny thing is, at the time, even the cheapest, easiest to get in a bar Czech beer was still like hands and feet above mass market American beers, because they still give a shit.
Yeah,
if I'm going to say that.
Yeah. Go ahead. So, it's been one of those days.
So anyway, yeah, I have a lot of pleasant memories attached to this Gambrinus beer, and you know, I kind of put together a basic Czech lager recipe that I thought would be a pretty good approximation of it, but. You know, the best I can do is put it in the coldest little corner of my house. It's not really lagering temperatures.
Right.
You know, I have a feeling I'm going to get some off flavors and things like that, and that may even affect the long-term viability of this yeast strain. But, you know, I don't know when Y-Yeast is going to release this again, if ever. So I want to hold on to it for a little bit, and I want to kind of put a pin in it and let me come back to it when I've got better equipment and better ability to do that.
So why wouldn't they release it again? It's just not that popular of a yeast, or
you know, the it's these specific brewery strains that they tend to do in a kind of a quarterly basis. They at least my homebrew store carries three or four of them per quarter, and they advertise them that way. And I know that there are other breweries from the Czech Republic that have had similar strains released. There's the Budvar and the Pilsner Raquel, which is where, like, if you've heard of the name or the type of beer, a Pilsner, it is this beer from Pilsner Raquel, that they're essentially copying the style of.
Hmm.
It's the original golden beer. Before that, everything was kind of dark and more like stoutish, porter-ish, or just dark grains. that golden lager was an original thing for them. Anyway, again, I'm digressing.
That's okay. I started you. I started you digressing. Go ahead. So you're going to save this yeast.
Yeah, I'm going to save it, and I'm going to save it for probably months, maybe even a year or two before I can get a really good temperature control system that I can do a really reliable, you know, 50, 55 degree lagering ferment on. The plan here is that I'm going to freeze it. And I'm going to freeze it in just a basic freezer. I'm going to use some just the basic ice pack kind of the chemical ice pack kind of a things just to buffer it. Because, you know, we live in a world where your freezer is set to a certain temperature, but that temperature is a lie. There's a range. Like, it'll go 2 or 3 degrees higher, 2 or 3 degrees lower, and that kind of variability is really bad for yeast suspension, it turns out. Mm-hmm. So the idea of including a chemical ice pack like that is basically to stabilize that freeze, so that if it goes a little too high, the ice pack is there to keep it at the same proper temperature.
Yeah.
So... The funny thing is that yeast themselves, the cells themselves, can survive freezing just fine. What is the most damaging part of this is actually water. Water in the cells will expand, like we all know from school.
Yeah.
It'll form crystals, and those crystals can break down the cell walls. Once the cell wall is gone, then just the cell is gone. Or cell membranes. I forget which. I believe... yeast just have the membrane. So in order to protect the yeast, there are a few things that I want to do. The biggest thing is that in making up the culture that I used, I want to get as much water out of it as possible. And what I did here, let me back up a second. I made a really simple beer wort because I was working with a beer, and I'm probably going to make a braggot out of this in the future because I'm really curious to see if I can mix some light honey with some like lager yeast and get a good braggot that way.
Oh yeah.
But for now I was just making a basic beer, and we could make a basic, must with some yeast and some honey and some yeast nutrient if we wanted to. But, since the wort has all of the nutrient yeast basically needs at low concentrations, I just went with some, you know, some DME, mixed up to a gravity of 1045, which is probably even a little high for this purpose. And I took a few squirts of that yeast cake, the trub at the bottom of the fermenter, if you will, and let that sit for a couple days and let it ferment out the wort. Then I put it in the fridge, and that kind of settled all the yeast out of the wort suspension. And I got all of the liquid I could off of that until I just had the yeasty sludge at the bottom of the container.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really helps with the yeast surviving in these freezing temperatures is actually adding some glycerin to it. And ideally, we're looking at like 15% glycerin, although apparently you can fudge this a little bit. So what I did, I went on Amazon and I got these little, they're 12 milliliter vials. They have a functional capacity of 11 milliliters. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even use that much. I took one of my kids' medicine eyedroppers and some vegetable glycerin that I also got off of Amazon, sanitized that eyedropper really, really well, and poured some glycerin into a sanitized container. And then I just added 1.5 milliliters to every vial I was going to use, and took that sludge from the bottom of my jars after I had fermented it out and taken all the, basically it was a hopless beer, off the top. Mm-hmm. And, put 8.5 mils of that sludge in the vial. And so that's how I wound up with, I need to do a double check on the count. I think I wound up with about 8 or 9 vials of yeast that are being saved for this purpose.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So what's the, I mean, you're all up on, you know, you're a hell of a lot more scientific than I am. Although science was one of my favorite subjects when I was a kid in school, but hell, that was 50 years ago. you know, so I mean, it sounds like you're doing everything all correctly. Are you pretty sure, you have a pretty high degree of confidence? It sounds like that this is going to work out, right?
Well, I'm going to put this at 80% confidence.
Reasonable.
I've never done this before. I'm pretty sure that I'm getting a good yeast sample in the first place. I mean, this is the second generation for this yeast. I took the pack from Y yeast and I pitched that into this beer, and then I'm taking the sludge from that beer to make this round of the frozen yeast cells. You know, if you get around to like a fifth generation of yeast, then most people will report like there's mutation possibilities and off flavors and nasty things like that. We just want to avoid. So yeah, it probably would have been better if I had just built up a starter colony with that original bag. Frozen it and maybe taken one of these vials to make the Pilsner that I've got lagering in my utility room now.
Well,
it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we come back on show number 264, you know, and you're brewing your batch of Braggot with one of these vials, you know, we'll know.
Right.
You know, I mean, next year, you know, we'll know. So, I mean, it sounds like, it sounds like you get everything all worked out. I mean, you got a good plan. I mean, like I say, the science of it all. I mean, it sounds like you know what you're doing. Hey, 80% confidence. I mean, that's a good starting point, you know?
Yeah, we'll see if it works. And, you know, at the end of the day, this, I probably put $25 of materials between the vegetable glycerin, these little plastic vials, and some DME into this. Yeah. So if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And I'll just have to be really watchful of Y yeast whenever they get around to releasing the strain again. You know?
Well, I mean, you'll never know. I mean, it's just like this mead making thing that we're all into. I mean, unless you try it, you're not going to know. And, you know, my daddy used to tell me all the time when I was a kid, you know, when opportunity knocks, open the door, because if you don't, you never know what's going to be standing on the other side, you know?
Right.
You know, I open the door all the time, a little more cautiously now that I'm a little bit older. But, you know, I mean, and I used to be able to fling the door open and say, how are you? You know, but no, I think you got a good thing going there. I was, you know, you kind of prompted me into thinking about this yeast washing thing. And I'm, you know, I would do it as an experiment just to see, you know, just to try it.
Right.
But then, you know, I got to go back to something that Ryan said here sometime back about, you know, because I think we lightly touched on this yeast washing thing once. For maybe 30 seconds, and his response was, yeah, but when you can go out and buy a packet of yeast for like $4, you know, why would you want to save mason jars full of yeast, you know?
Yeah.
So
realistically, this is an astronomical amount of effort just to save a yeast strain. It's not just the expense of all the ingredients that, you know.
Yeah.
They're nominal. At the end of the month, I spent $25, and it's just for, it's more for shits and giggles to see if it works than anything else.
Yeast washing, could you go through the same steps that you're doing now with, say, 71B? I mean, you know, you got a bunch of 71B sitting at the bottom of your fermenter after you've racked. Could you do the same thing with that?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, you could definitely do this. I would sooner do like a wash and direct pitch onto something else than freeze it, just because like 71B, you can get a 5 gram packet for
$1.50.
Right, if that. Yeah. It's ridiculously cheap.
Yeah.
But you know, the thing that that strikes me, this would be a good thing for people to know how to do, or at least have a reference for how to do. If you recall our guest that does that wild ferment of cider every year, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but what if one year you get a spectacular strain of yeast that just gives you really good results with your cider, and you want to hold on to that and make sure that next year is not an accident.
There you go.
This is how you do that.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, that makes all the sense in the world there. I like I said, I would probably try it just to try it, but you know, I don't know what am I going to do with $100 worth of yeast in, you know, 4 or 5 mason jars? I mean,
right?
You know, I don't, you know, unless you've got big brewers. I mean, you know, somebody like Carvin Wilson, who's got, you know, 2 dozen fermenters going on in his house. I could see maybe hanging on to some yeast, but by the same token, I mean, you know, if you can afford the amount of fermenters, big stainless steel fermenters that Carvin's got, you can buy all the yeast you want.
Right.
And I have no problem doing that too. I mean, but to do it just to say, hey, I did it, you know, it'd be interesting to go through the steps and understand the process a little bit better. So, you know, maybe you can talk about it a little more fluently the next time you come across somebody who else is talking about it. At least you've got that experience, you know. So, but I get it. I mean, but you know, by the same token, I mean, you know, you're talking about a yeast that is not readily available. It's not $1.50 a sachet, who knows the next time it'll ever come around, if at all.
Right.
You know.
So it, for whatever reason, it has some emotional attachment to me, and it's like, it's worth me trying.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, good stuff. Let us know how it turns out. And like I say, on show, now this is a commitment here, on show 264. Okay. We're gonna see if we can't coax Jeff into digging out one of them vials and making a braggot. So, and I
on it. 264 is on my calendar.
And I don't even know what the date for that is. Somebody out there, one of our fans, if you could email us and let us know what date show 264 is. Just keep in mind that we do this 6 and 2 thing, plus the holidays. So that's going to take a pretty good sized calculator. So anyway. Facebook, cruising around the Facebook thing. I think we had some fun last time doing it. I thought we'd do it again. I ran across one from Joey Pellegrino. He's in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I don't know, maybe you saw this one too. I think this was in Modern Mead Making group, Modern Mead Makers group. And Joey says he's got some different ideas floating around his head for using nuts and seeds in mead. And he was looking for some recommendations and techniques and best practices, you know, particularly extracting the fat and reducing the likelihood of a rancid, mead as a result. And I know that the fats in nuts are something that you really have to contend with. You really got to pay attention to that because, you know, you could possibly ruin a nice mead with that. A lot of folks responded to this. I'm not going to go through every one of them, but there were several that came back with some pretty good ideas. Stephen, and I hope I'm saying his name right, Stadnikar, I think is his last name. Anyway, Stephen writes, currently have some walnuts toasted then as much oil as he could get out of that process. And then he's got them soaking in some bourbon. Of course, my eyeballs went right to that, the mention of bourbon, that he plans to put in the freezer and to try to get any more oils out, the liquid and everything, put it in the freezer to try to get the oil to come to the top and then, of course, scrape the resulting oils off after it freezes. So Brian Sullivan, he said to boil them, chill the liquid, and then skim the fats off the top, and then use the liquid in your must. That seems to be the most commonest practice.
Yep.
When dealing with nuts. And
I've seen that advice several times, yeah.
Yeah. Tony Qualls, he says that technique is great for peanuts. But the higher fat nuts, not so much. Of course, the higher fat nuts are going to be things like walnuts and maybe pecans. I don't know about pecans, but certainly walnuts.
Macadamia, I'd imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, macadamia nuts. The macadamias are really buttery flavored, kind of a soft nut. So yeah, maybe a little bit difficult with that, but. Certainly peanuts, cashews. I'd love to try a cashew. I love cashews.
Cashews are delicious.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to have to stop these digressions, though, as to what we think would be delicious and get back to these peanuts.
I know. I mean, you know, a cashew, even to mix them up. I make my own peanut butter, but I use half peanuts and half cashews and olive oil. And a little bit of salt and about 2 tablespoons of honey. And I make my own peanut butter. Oh, dude, that's good on like French toast and a little bit of that and some maple syrup. Oh, that's good stuff.
Oh, hell yeah. That sounds delicious. You had me ready to spend 5 minutes talking about like black walnut and bourbon. And then you hit me with this stuff.
Well, hey, let's talk about black walnut and bourbon. How would you go about treating that?
Oh, man. I'm not certain about how I would go about treating that because I've had one experience working with nuts, and I've talked about this at least twice on the show, where I tried making a tincture with Everclear, and that was just atrocious.
Tinctures are not those are really hard to do with nuts. It took me, I tried to make an almond extract. The same way, and that's really hard.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't want to get into that extract thing. But go ahead. I mean,
For one, I would see two different approaches to this. For one, I would be keen to try the tincture approach with a better base liquor. And what I've discovered is ridiculously good for tinctures. If you don't have a Costco membership, get a Costco membership or a Costco gift card to let you go to a Costco. And make sure you live in a state where Costco can sell alcohol. Because Kansas Costcos do not sell alcohol. But Missouri Costcos, which is 20 minutes from me.
Yeah, it's like across the street, isn't it?
Right, yeah. It's, it's spitting distance or, a long walk if you got the determination for it. They will sell any alcohol they can find. And the Kirkland brand of French vodka, not the American vodka, the French vodka, they will sell a 1.75 liter huge bottle of this guy for $20.
Oh, wow.
And it is smooth and delightful in a mixed drink. But what you really want it for is tinctures, because that smooth, easy drinking alcohol gives you a great base to start with.
Yeah.
I've used it for sweetgrass, which is, There are legal ramifications to using that in alcohol, but the Poles have a vodka that is flavored with sweetgrass called Zubrowka, which is delicious. A handful of other things I've tried with it as well, including my wife made some. You can't really call it gin because it wasn't distilled, but she took the vodka and added like juniper and some other herbs to make a gin like drink that I thought was delightful and she thought was too strong. But yeah, it makes a great base. I would be keen to try another nut experiment with that instead of the Everclear, which is just like action packed with fusels and other nastiness that makes it really hard to bring the first.
You might as well use turpentine.
Right, yeah. Nothing good was going to come of that.
Yeah.
You know, and I've never actually tried Mississippi's recommendation on this either. I think he mentioned for pecans was basically to toast them in an oven for a while and then put them in like a brown paper bag and toss them up to get the oils all saturated into the brown paper.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I don't know how effective that would be, but I'd be willing to give it a shot. I mean, especially for like a 1 gallon, 2 gallon batch, something small just for the sake of trying it. Why not?
Yeah. The paper bag, I've toasted nuts in the oven before and I put them on, paper towels. You don't want to do that.
Oh, really?
No, you don't want to do that. The paper bag idea works much better because you can seal the paper bag up and rotate the bag because you need to keep doing that so that the bag comes in contact with the skin of the nut so that it will, you know, kind of it acts like an extractor. I mean, the oils are going to soak into the paper bag, but you got to keep rotating it. The paper napkin trick, it just doesn't work. Besides that, the paper napkin gets a little oily, and then they start to disintegrate after a while.
Yeah, and that doesn't help you eating.
Yeah, I mean, the paper bag thing, I mean, if you can even find paper bags anymore, you know, that's the best thing to do. I mean, if nothing else, get some even butcher paper and just, you know, staple up a little bag. If you have to, that'll work too.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
But yeah, the roasting definitely is what I would like to do. I would roast them first, you know, and then, well, of course, we're talking about soaking in alcohol, right? So after you've roasted them, then what? Just crush them up and put them in a jar with some bourbon?
You know, there are so many different directions you could take from that point forward. I mean, we could split this into like 4 different 1 gallon batches and do just one that is just the tincture, one that is like the roasted nuts going into a tincture, one that's just the roasted nuts going right into the mead, and another that's the roasted nuts going into a bourbon that goes into the mead. And man, I could see this being good any number of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. I mean, I would even, my thinking here is for the bourbon thing. I mean, I love the bourbon idea. And black walnuts and bourbon, I mean, they go together so well anyway. I would probably do that. I mean, you know, mason jars. There's another purpose for mason jars besides making jelly. And that's to store wood chips or wood, you know, your wood aging material in with your favorite alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I would do the same thing with these walnuts, you know, even regular walnuts, regular walnuts. You know, throw them on a cookie sheet, you know, get some, and I wouldn't roast them without doing it on some parchment paper. Cause that'll help soak up, some of the oil too. And then, you know, probably, 350 degrees maybe for 10, 12 minutes or, you know, you don't want to burn the nuts, but, you know, you want to kind of dry them out and draw that oil up.
Yeah, I might even go low and slow and do like 300 for 20 minutes.
Yeah, even that would work.
So.
Yeah, yeah, because the whole idea is to heat them up so that it, you know, forces the oil to come to the top. You know, you will get kind of a roasty flavor into the nut itself, which, you know, doesn't hurt. And then, you know, we'll do the paper bag trick. Let them come back down to room temperature, get them out of the bag. You don't want them sitting in the oil.
Right.
And then, you know, put them in a mason jar and fill the jar up with some good bourbon. You know?
That sounds like a game plan to me. Jeez.
Yeah, and let them sit. Now, You know, the other thing you can do too is after a couple of days, put the jar of bourbon in the refrigerator, or even put it in the freezer.
Yeah.
The bourbon's not going to freeze, and the oils, you know, should come to the top, and you should get a nice little cake of oil that you can just use a plastic spoon, you know, a sanitized plastic spoon, and just scrape the oil off the top. I don't see
and really, if we're talking about bourbon at this point, I don't even know that you need to sanitize it. I mean,
but that's true. Yeah, it's alcohol. I mean, you know, it's going to, you know, that level of alcohol is going to kill anything that was on the spoon to begin with.
Pretty much. I would be lying if I said I'd never in my 20s like used a little cheap alcohol weighing around for an antiseptic once or twice.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in the same here. So, yeah, I mean, this whole nut thing, you know, Joey, you know, out there in Cincinnati, Ohio, I think you're onto something here. And, you know, would love to know more about your quest for a good nut mead, you know, that you're going to put together here. You know, there's another method I didn't think about. You know, you can make a nut milk and do the same thing. And now we're not talking something of lactose. Okay, this is not a lactose because you're not going to put milk into your this is not like milk flavored or, you know, walnut flavored milk. They call it nut milk because it's the juice of the nut, basically. And it's real simple. You take your nuts and you soak them in water overnight. They become real soft. And then you drain them and rinse them out real good, really well. And then you used fresh water and put them in a blender and just blend the crap out of them. You don't want it real thin, but you don't want it real pasty either. You want it something like a vanilla milkshake. Okay. You want some texture to it, and then you wrap it up in a muslin bag. You need something that's not like cheesecloth. You need to use like a muslin bag. In fact, they make nut bags for nut milk bags for doing this. You can go on Amazon and just and look it up. You know, pour your nut milk into the bag and just let it sit, let it drain into another vessel. And that's going to take a long time because you don't want to squeeze the bag. You let it naturally drip into the bag. You don't want to squeeze it in because you'll squeeze all kinds of other crap through that muslin. It's just the same thing as brewing. You know, after you steep your grains, you don't want to squeeze the bag. Okay, you let it drip, and when it's done, it's done. And then you can take that nut milk and put it in the freezer, you know, I would let it sit for a little while, and then put it in the freezer, and it'll probably develop, you know, a degree of film or oil at the top, and you can take that off as well, and then thaw the nut milk out and use that in your mead. So I don't know why that wouldn't work.
Yeah, I would be concerned that with you know, fat winding up in that as well, or the oils, I should say, winding up as well. But yeah, refrigeration, freezing, whatever it takes to isolate that, yeah, that would work.
Yeah, you know, and you're more than likely going to get a little film of fat, you know, protein at the top of the carboy. You know, just when you're racking, just rack it down so that layer is still above the level of the intake on your racking cane, so you don't suck it all into the next vessel.
Right.
I don't know that I would age anything with nuts in it for too terribly long. I would probably want to drink it sooner than later. To avoid it even happening in the bottle, to a degree. But I mean, come on, a little, you know, what would develop in a bottle probably isn't going to hurt it anyway. So, what the heck. But anyway, enough on nuts. You had a couple too, didn't you?
Oh, sure. I've got a handful of them actually.
Go ahead.
See, a lot of these are newbie questions, but I feel it's really useful because you never know when people are going to stumble on this podcast and which episodes they're going to play first here.
Yeah.
So I had one from Yuquan that asks, hello, folks. I've been wondering these two questions for the past 2 weeks, still left without a clue. Number one, should mead fermented with chunks of apple be called apple melomel or cider? I think I read a similar post somewhere that traditionally cider should just be apple juice without adding water. What do you think? Number two, I force carbonated this cider stored at 5 degrees Celsius, used an auto siphon straight from the keg to 330 ml bottles, failed to keep all that good carbonation. To simply put, keg auto siphon to beer, to bottle filter, to bottle, and basically auto siphon didn't seem to work. No matter how high the keg was, how hard I pumped, liquid did not travel as it would with the still mead. Foam was created from the start all the way to the bottle. Please let me know any of these questions were posted.
Yeah, I know that one right off the bat.
Yep. That's
Stir your mead, dude.
Well, that and this is we're talking about filling a pressurized, a carbonated mead from a pressurized keg into a bottle. You really need to be using.
I misunderstood. I thought his mead was carbonated like he didn't, you know, full of CO2, and he was trying to get it through the racking cane into the next vessel. Because I've done that. That doesn't work too well either, because it just foams up in the tube.
Well, that's exactly what's happening, except he's trying to bottle it instead of
taking
it into the next one. In this case, you really need a counter pressure bottle filler or like a beer gun or something along those lines that will. The idea is that the reason you're getting that foam is the pressure inside that keg is much higher than the pressure inside that bottle. And the minute you put liquid into it, all of the dissolved gas in that carbonated liquid wants to equalize the pressure, and it just foams up like crazy.
Yeah.
So the solution to that is to use a counter pressure filler that will make an equal amount of pressure inside the bottles first, and then let you transfer that liquid without disrupting the dissolved CO2.
True.
As to that first question with that mead fermented with chunks of apple being called melomel or sizer, I have seen a lot of posts on this online lately. This idea that if you have a mead made with juice, it should be called the sizer, and a mead made with chunks of fruit should be called a melomel. And I don't know where this came from, but it seems like somebody's been giving out really bad advice.
Well, if it were me, I would call it a melomel. Sizers to me are apple juice and honey. A melomel is fruit and honey. Now, apple is a fruit. I think there's a lot of people out there that think a melomel is nothing but blackberries. a fruit mead is a melomel. So whether it's a peach or a nectarine or an apple, an orange, it's still a melomel.
Right.
So,
yeah, to my way of thinking, this term melomel is this giant umbrella that includes all fruit.
Yeah.
And this term sizer is a smaller umbrella that includes all apples, whether you're talking about the juice, whether that's filtered or unfiltered, the fruit or the pomace or what have you. To be perfectly honest with you, with our audience, just cutting up chunks of apple and putting it into a mead, unless you're wanting a mead with a very slight apple flavor, seems like a really inefficient and not very effective way to get an apple flavored mead, because there's a lot of water in apple fruit, and you're going to get a lot of crud and fiber from that fruit as it as the yeast digests the sugars and stuff, and the fruit pomace kind of starts to break down, it seems like a much better idea to use a pressed cider in this aspect. Yeah. I mean, the reason cider mills do that is because that's what works easiest. We've just figured this out. But to me, I don't think the idea of putting chunks of apple into a mead and calling it a melomel and not a sizer makes any sense. Sizers are, you know, a mead made with
apple juice and honey. Yeah.
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 Whether you're juicing that apple or that apple is kind of juicing itself inside the fermenter, I still think it's a sizer.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, you know. I don't get hung up on based on everything you can read out there on the internet, there's a lot of people out there who insist that a melomel is some kind of a berry. I mean, it's just, you know, it has to have some kind of a berry. You know, why do all melomels have berries in it? I mean, come on, that's not the case. Apple juice, sizer. And I agree about the apple chunks. I mean, rather than chunk up an apple and, of course, unless you peel the skin off and risk, you know, another yeast, you know, dropping another yeast in the batch. I mean, if you don't treat the apples first before you start, I mean, I don't know where he is in this process, but. You know, just to drop a handful of apples in a mead. I mean, that's not going to do a lot. You might as well just get an apple concentrate, right, and add that to secondary, you know, taste it as you go to get your apple flavor. If that's what you're looking for, I mean, it's, you know, it's a viable solution. But I just don't know that I'd sit there and chunk up an apple and drop it into a mead. I don't know that that would be a good solution. I mean, it's a solution, but not a good solution.
Well, and at the end of the day, there is also a part of me that feels like this idea of calling a mead made with apple juice but not apple chunks a melo or a sizer, and, you know, if a mead is made with chunks a melomel, and blah blah blah, we're really spinning our wheels on semantics here.
Yeah.
Just make what tastes good, guys.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to. Warren Earl in Mesa, Arizona. This, I got a kick out of this one. This one was also in the Mead Makers of modern. I got to get used to that. They changed their name, Modern Mead Making. Now I think it is. Warren Earl in Mesa, Arizona. That's like right down the street from me too. My wife has tasked me with a challenge. Mind you, she's not a drinker. Seriously. But she wants me to make a birthday cake funfetti flavored mead. You know. All I got is that it will be a sweet sack mead, and he's thinking on using an actual birthday cake mix. I don't think you want it. Unless you're brewing beer, that may be one thing. I don't know. I don't know about dumping a cake mix into a mead. I don't think that's what you want to do. I haven't tried it, but hey, what the hell? As an experiment, I mean, who knows? I don't want to use artificial flavorings like cake mix, but I'm kind of stumped. So I thought maybe we could toss it around here at the Mead House a little bit and see what we come up with. Now, I'm thinking something along the lines of a braggot, okay, a sweet braggot. Sure. And I'm thinking like biscuit. I'm thinking victory grains, maybe some oat grains to give you that cake sense, okay? Mm-hmm. And then for your funfetti, these are the little colored little things you sprinkle on the top. I'm thinking, I don't know whether, I mean, you might be able to mix a couple of different fruits, maybe cherry and strawberry, and try to see if you can get strawberry and cherry to come through. or maybe just a single fruit, and making some kind of a braggot out of it. You know, like I say, take it up a couple of notches on the sweetness level. Maybe even throw in some lactose, sugar, maybe a pound of lactose into it. You get a little kind of a creamy, get that creamy, that moist cake mouthfeel, maybe.
Right.
That's kind of the direction I'm going with it. How about you, Jeff?
So I've got a few different ideas here, and I actually did see this post as I was browsing around earlier today. But this is a can of worms. This is a great speculation exercise.
Yeah,
I do love that you brought this up. So I don't know that I would even go fruity with this. Like as I understand it, we're talking about trying to get a mead that kind of mimics that. The birthday cake, quote unquote, flavor of ice cream, which is in turn trying to, it's not even to my understanding trying to be like the birthday cake itself so much as just the batter of the birthday cake.
Like a cookie dough batter type of deal, but only a cake batter.
Yeah. Just trying to have like a cake batter flavor to it. So yeah, I would go sweet on this. I would go cloyingly sweet on this, honestly.
Yeah.
I would probably do. I would keep the grains relatively light, but I would do something in the neighborhood of a stout in terms of stout or barley wine or something like a little heavier in terms of the amount of grains. I seem to recall. I had a book on making homemade sodas as opposed to like beer, mm-hmm. things like that, just soda pop, where the author recommended for a 5-gallon batch to steep a half pound or a pound of something like 60L crystal malt into some of the fruity flavor pops to give it that kind of a the perception of having almost a crustiness for like cherry or blueberry pie.
Yeah, there you go.
I could see using that. Lactose also could be really good here to give it some sweetness and some body. Maltose obviously would be good for body.
Maltose,
as well.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What about malib? I wonder if that would give you that. I mean, the people have been using that in like cherry mead to give it that cherry pie type flavor.
Yeah, I don't want to go fruity with this though.
Of course. Yeah. Then now you're leaning toward more pie than a cake.
Right. I would definitely go heavy on vanilla.
Warren, what are you doing? go ahead.
I would put 2 or 3 vanilla beans in this, if not more, a lot more. I mean, I would go heavy on vanilla with this because that vanilla flavor is so characteristic of just that white birthday cake.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think you could over vanilla this, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Warren, you might have stumped us here at the Meat House. Of course, Ryan isn't here. I'm sure he'd have something to say about it, too. But we want to wish you all the luck. And Warren, if you're I know you're going to listen to the episode because I told you so in the Facebook thing, so we definitely want to know more about this funfetti flavored cake dough mead that you're going to come up with, so let us know what's going on. So Jeff, what else you got there?
Well, Warren, definitely tell us if you have any successes, and if you have the humility, tell us about failures. Tell us about those too,
and let us know what your wife thinks, or if she sent you packing.
So the next question I had was from Rich Jack. He says, "I've asked this somewhere else. I figured I'd ask here as well to get more opinions. How long do you wait to see if your batch took off before repitching?" For some more background, he says he started his off at 11:03. Sunday night, using some instructions from Mead Maker. It's been 48 hours, not a bubble, no drop in gravity. no smell of yeast in the must. He's using USO5, and the temperature is 60 the entire time.
Hmm. Kind of high for USO5, but it should start even at that. Especially, I mean, if you threw some nutrient in right at the beginning, right up front. I mean, as soon as you put your water in and get it mixed up, throw some nutrient in along with the USO5. It should start off, but so many variables here, you know. I mean, some of it even depends on the temperature.
Right. The temperature of 60 the entire time, I don't know if that's the temperature that it was when he mixed the must versus what it's been stored at. We don't know if he rehydrated it in a warm liquid and then it got temperature shocked when it went into a 60 degree must.
Or dry pitch even.
Right. Yeah, and I know Fermentis does recommend a dry pitch on USO5 or SO4, both of which I really like and needs, and both of which I use at a dry pitch without rehydrating with GoFirm.
Yep, I do too.
Yeah. So we don't know what his protocol was for that, though. So, yeah. If you're taking it from a warm rehydration to a cool must, or if there's if the rehydration liquid and the must are more than about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, there is a chance you just shock the yeast and they're going to be slow, sluggish, or just not going to take off because they're being finicky. If you dry pitched it, that is not a problem. They can potentially take a little bit longer to take off that way just because they need to rehydrate and they need to build themselves up that way.
Yeah.
The long and short of it is, if you, I expect to see action by 48 hours.
Yeah.
Realistically, I would give it another 24. And if I don't see action by 72 hours, I need to repitch.
Yeah. Throw another bag of yeast in.
Yeah. And if you're using USO5 and you didn't do the rehydration protocol with that, you just dry pitched it like the manufacturer recommends, maybe try hydrating it with some GoFirm. Give it a little kick in the pants and a little head start.
Something else he might try too is to take the temperature up. Go in 2 degree intervals about every 12 hours and, get it up into this about the 72 area. You don't want to necessarily go higher than that. You're going to have to give it some time because you don't want to boil the yeast per se. So 2 degrees every 12 hours. Now, this was told to me by somebody who knows a whole lot more about this than I do. Highly recommended from a professional mead maker who has lots of experience. 2 degrees every 12 hours over the course of, maybe a couple of days. If you don't see any activity by then like Jeff says, repitch. And, keep the temperature up there around 70, 72 degrees to get it started and then start taking your temperatures down and step them down again every 12 hours. That's what I would do. And if after that you don't see any activity, then you definitely got something going on, pH, something else happening, and then you want to go. You really don't want to do this. I did it once and it's a very long, drawn out process. When you have to pitch another yeast to get it to restart, okay, you have to take a little bit of must out and put some yeast in it, you get it going. And then over the course of several days, you start adding it back and forth, until you get to the point where you've transferred all of your must from one container into another container. And there's a, is Scott Labs or Lalamond? If you go to themeadhouse.com, I believe I believe there's a link there that will take you to the repitch document. I don't recall off the top of my head who put it out, but it's a step-by-step. And if it's not there, I'll find it and put it up. But it's a step-by-step on repitching, restarting a stuck mead. Okay, but it's a, you know, be advised, you're going to need some time alone with your mead, a long time alone with your mead, because it takes a while to go through this process. So, and that's all I'll say on that.
Well, and I think that was Lalamon and not necessarily Scott Labs. I could be wrong. It's been so long since I've looked at that myself.
Yeah.
I will say that I've taken the shortcut approach to that, where I start I rehydrate something like K1B or EC1118, one of the champagne yeasts,
right,
with a really aggressive streak to it. I get that going, and then I just I take the half of whatever that liquid is. Of must, and I just add that to it, and then give it a couple hours, add another half of the total liquid I have now, until I've got a good 2 liter size portion, and it's bubbling away and everything looks to be copacetic, and then I just dump that in. Now, at that point, you are not getting the nice, clean, smooth beer-like ferment of the US05, that American ale thing. It's a champagne yeast.
Right.
Your yeast character is going to change. It's okay. It's not what you're looking for, but that, if that's what it takes to get this to go, that's what it takes to get this to go.
I got a feeling he's probably, sometimes these things take a while. And, if you took your must down to 60 degrees soon after you pitched, I'll bet just taking the temperature back up, wait until it starts up, then start taking it. Man, that's what I do. I don't pitch and then immediately take my temps down. I wait till it gets going, and I'll give it a good 6, 7, 8 hours even after I see the first signs before I start taking it down in temperature. And I go down 2 degrees about every 5 to 6 hours. So that I just don't, it's like tossing a baby out in the cold, it's like tossing a naked baby out in the cold. I mean, you're not going to do that without wrapping it up in a blanket and jacket and everything else. You know what I mean? So gradually, and we're not talking about freezing babies here. Gosh, talk about getting off on a tangent. Anyway, you get my drift.
The Mead House will raise your babies for you.
And Ash, by the way, I just poured a couple of fingers of Smoky Pete. Dude, I'm loving this stuff. So here's to Ash Fishbine and Smoky Pete at Sap House Meadery. And that's a wrap.